Welcome to Familiar Strangers. We are broadcasting live from CITR 101.9 FM on the UBC Vancouver campus, located on the current unceded, unsurrendered territory of the Musqueam First Nation and the historical shared territory of the Hunkaminam and Squamish Shunam speaking Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people. I'm your host, Celine. Again, I will emphasize the importance of recognizing whose land we are on. This is a show that discusses urban affairs, and for this specific reason, it is important that we stress that these lands were stolen and continue to be unceded today, meaning there were no treaties signed. Today, for this episode, I'm going to be joined by two close friends, Zainab, who was in the episode 2 weeks ago when we talked to Professor Priti Narayan about imagining the urban periphery, specifically in the region of her research, Chennai. So if you missed that, make sure to go back and listen on the CITR website and hopefully Spotify sometime soon. And also Harmela, who is the president of the student executive here at CITR. I've been meaning to get her on an episode for a bit, and she's amazing. This is going to be amazing. We will be joined by Peter Hudson, Dr. Peter Hudson, Associate Professor at the Geography Department here at UBC, and today's episode will be about Black dispossession under capitalist and imperialist systems. Something I'm going to start doing is starting these episodes with a song that feels good or important or simply brings love and joy to the person we're interviewing. So this time I asked Dr. Hudson, and his song was Be Thankful for What You've Got by Massive Attack. We're going to take a short ad break and be right back.
F7 Entertainment presents hardcore punk band Military Gun, performing cuts from their critically acclaimed album Life Under the Gun in Vancouver on Friday, March 8th at the Rickshaw Theater. Catch them in Vancouver before their upcoming performances at Bonnaroo and Coachella this year. Tickets on sale now at f7entertainment.com.
Old or New Testament?
I think the New Testament.
The question is, Pilate. Remember Pilate from the New Testament?
Pontius Pilate, he fiddled well.
Yeah, no, well, just a minute. Let me ask the question, then you can give me the answer, okay? Did Pilate want Jesus to be crucified?
Pontius Pilate washed his hands of it.
So did he want him to be crucified?
Yeah.
No. 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 Well, find a good church. It'll help you.
We're back. You're listening to Familiar Strangers. I'm your host, Celine, and I'm joined by
Zainab,
Harmela.
And we are also joined by Dr. Peter Hudson. Zainab, Harmela, would you like to give an introduction?
Yeah. My name's Zainab. I'm an undergraduate student in the Department of Geography. And I took a class with Dr. Hudson last semester, and I am super excited to kind of get into some chats about Black history and to pick his brain a little.
Hi, my name is Harmela. I'm in my third year of Romance Studies, and I'm also president of CITR. Celine told me about Dr. Hudson, and I'm just really excited to be in this room right now and able to have this discussion, especially during Black History Month.
So. Awesome. And we are joined by Dr. Peter Hudson. He is an associate professor at the Department of Geography at the University of British Columbia, with his research largely about Black dispossession under capitalism and resistance to said forms of dispossession. Could you also please introduce yourself?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for having me on. I'm, as you said, an associate professor of geography associate professor of geography here at UBC, recently returning to Vancouver after many years away. I was just most recently in African American studies and history at the University of California, Los Angeles, and before that I was in Vanderbilt and at the University of Buffalo, and I did my PhD many years ago in American Studies at New York University. And I just want to say it's a real pleasure to be back in Vancouver and to be on CITR for the first time as someone who grew up on both CITR and Discorder, and I think both of them helped shape my consciousness in what was the cultural wasteland of West Point Grey. So it's a real treasure that both institutions still exist. I also want to say thank you for having me on during Black History Month. As you probably know, yesterday was the birthday of the great Black feminist and communist Claudia Jones. Today is the anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X, and tomorrow is the birthday of W.E.B. Du Bois. And so it's an auspicious time for us to be appearing here. Though on a more kind of sadder note, we've also, as much as we talk about Black excellence as part of Black history, we've also seen that the Linda Thomas Greenfield, the African-American ambassador to the United Nations, has just again vetoed a ceasefire in Gaza. So we have to both acknowledge the importance of Black history, but also acknowledge that there's a genocide going on against the Palestinian people, and I think I'd be remiss not to open without that acknowledgement.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. This is Future Celine talking. I would just like to note that this was recorded on February 22nd, so all dates, events, the news, it's all relative to that day. What Dr. Hudson is talking about is the United States' ceasefire veto in the UN Security Council on Tuesday, February 21st, a day before this was recorded.
Would you like to talk about your journey?
Sure. I mean, yeah, I think, as I said, I grew up, I was born in Edmonton. I grew up in Vancouver. I went to high school at Lord Byng, and didn't go to UBC. I didn't see UBC as a place that, first of all, had a lot of people of color at that time, but also, you know, for me growing up, this was a really elitist institution that you know, I'd skateboard here or drink beer here, but it wasn't a place that I, other than Discorder and CITR, found much affiliation with. So I ended up going first to Langara and then to SFU. And kind of along the way there, along that journey, I encountered a quite incredible group of writers and artists and activists kind of clustered around Commercial Drive on Hastings Street, mainly in East Van, who were doing a lot of work on racial equity, protesting against the Iraq War, mm-hmm. Getting involved in questions of police brutality as well as indigenous land claims. And they were also then kind of questioning the forms of representation, literary and artistic representation in Canada, by really making claims for, you know, how do writers of color represent themselves within the kind of nationalist imagination of Canada? How do we incorporate questions of diaspora, of immigration and imperialism? And kind of doing work with this broad group of people led me to publish, as you know, a magazine called Diaspora, which I'm not a big fan of Black First, but it was like the first Black magazine published in Vancouver. It only had a couple of issues, but I think it was a kind of important venue and now an archive for a moment in Black Vancouver. And so it was a lot of the work that I did at that time with different writers and artists in Vancouver, which led me to actually leave Vancouver and pursue a PhD, where I ended up writing a dissertation and then a book on the history of Wall Street in the Caribbean.
I'm sorry, I did not mean to brush over the first answer you gave me. I was just reading, and so I wanted to say thank you for also acknowledging on air that there is a genocide going on in Gaza. My mind completely clicked out for a second, but yeah, thank you for that. Yeah,
I think it's also just really nice to hear about your journey as young people in Vancouver, because it kind of illustrates that even people who are faculty members at UBC have relationships with this place that are really diverse and not all rooted in academia and is actually rooted in relationships made within the places that you've lived. And yeah, so it's just really nice to hear that.
I'm from Edmonton too.
Oh.
You said Edmonton. I was like, what? Yeah. I have a question. You said you're not a fan of Diaspora, the magazine. Looking at it now, am I getting that correctly?
Oh no, I wouldn't say I'm not a fan of it. I would say that it's an artifact of a moment in my life, and you know, if I did it now, I'd probably do it differently. But I think it's an important artifact. I think it was an attempt at something, and I think going to Zainab's point, I think you know a lot of my first initial affiliations, my initial and intellectual affiliations weren't with the academy. And again, I think with the kind of writers and artists that I was meeting and who mentored me in Vancouver at that time, there was a clear sense that we all felt that being in Vancouver, especially as Black people, sure, we could say there's Hogan's Alley and there's some history here, but in some ways there was nothing, right? And so then, were we just going to all move to New York or move to Toronto or move to LA or move to London and try to find where Blackness was? For better or worse, did move. But the other thing is, well, if there's nothing here, we can create it. We can create it in any way we want. And then we can do some historical work to draw on Hogan's Alley or to find out who were the kind of earlier Black writers who existed in the province before we came for. And then, you know, and so this is, if you see Wade Compton's very important anthology, Bluesprint, it emerges out of that moment, and he did this amazing work to excavate all of these previous writers and to kind of create a text. And I remember having conversations with Wade around those time, at that time, and with other writers. It's like, we also realized, if we don't have a past here, we can at least create a future for other people. Mm-hmm. And we can think seven generations ahead and think, well, maybe there'll be writers who discover our writing. Maybe there'll be some young Black person who is going to be like, oh my God, there was a Hudson or a Compton or a David Odhiambo or some other writer. And they can say, we have a history in Vancouver and we can make a kind of claim here. Mm-hmm. I sometimes feel like a lot of that older work is forgotten, but I think every generation feels like that. But I think there's still something excited to be done here. And I also would say that this is a different city than when I knew it growing up here. I mean, the demographic has shifted, the wealth has shifted, they've cut down all the forests and continue to do so, and that's a whole other story. But I think there's something exciting here, you know, and I think it's really up to students, and especially at UBC, because I think there's still some potential here, and we're in a moment mm-hmm. of conflict at UBC where I think students are beginning to find their voice in particular ways that they maybe haven't for decades. So I mean, the future is yours.
That's exciting.
Yeah. Are there any intellectuals, writers that you look up to? Like, you mentioned that you want there to be a future Black community who can look back and say there was a Hudson and there were other writers and there were intellectuals who did build the space for us. Were there people for you when you were, like, starting your academic journey, intellectual journey?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I would say people like David George Morgan, who has an organization called Bibuno, Building Bridges United Number One, was an important figure for me. He was doing a lot of organizing here around the arts. I think there's a woman named Barbara Binns, who was, I think, working with the Vancouver Status of Women, was a teacher at Langara, who was involved in a lot of Black History Month organizations. She was important. Someone like Compton, David Odhiambo, were important to me. Andrea Fatona, who made one of the first films on Hogan's Alley back in the day with another woman named Cornelia Weingarten. Their examples were important. at SFU, a figure by the name of Roy Miki, who was a poet, very involved in the Japanese redress movement, what I would say was a mentor of mine, and was involved in bringing a lot of people of color involved in arts activism, and I think really showed us a mentor, was really a mentor to a lot of us. And then there was also people who we didn't know, but who were writing, right, and who we would turn to as writers outside of Vancouver. And for me, people like C.L.R. James from Trinidad, Walter Rodney from Guyana, Claude McKay from Jamaica, Toni Morrison. I could go on and on and on.
For sure. I'm going to ask this question now because you mentioned C.L.R. James. Mm-hmm. And I've been reading The Black Jacobins. And I'm sure that's such a basic text for you since you, like, you talk about the Haitian Revolution a lot. And this is something Zainab has mentioned. There's this quote, and it relates to my next question, but I'll just read it out loud. Great men make history, but only such history as it is possible for them to make. Their freedom of achievement is limited by the necessities of their environment. To portray the limits of those necessities and the realization, complete or partial, of all possibilities, that is the true business of the historian. And a little later, it continues, quote, the writer has sought not only to analyze, but to demonstrate in their movement and the economic forces of the age, their molding of society and politics, of men in the mass and individual men, the powerful reaction of these on their environment at one of those rare moments when society is at a boiling point and therefore fluid. That is very loaded, but essentially, to the listener, what C.L.R. James is, from my understanding, talking about is who gets to tell history. I'm bringing this up because, first of all, I read that the Haitian Revolution is a point of history that you find particularly significant. Secondly, you edited a print magazine, so I suppose there is great significance in literature and printed work for you. And thirdly, when I was reading one of your interviews, there was this particular quote where you talked about how it's important that when studying Black writers, to not only recall them as simply, quote, instantiations of Black identity or examples of the Black self, but rather to critique these writings because they are inherently methodology, in the sense that these are writers that are descendants who have suffered cruel history. Can we talk about this?
Yeah, no, thank you. I mean, there's a lot in your questions. The first thing I'd say, I mean, for me, the Black Jacobins isn't a basic or simple text.
Okay.
It's a text that I encountered as an undergraduate and have encountered it every year since, and every time I read it, mm-hmm. I'm kind of awakened to its complexity and to the depths of its argument. So it's like I always feel like I'm reading it for the first time. I think there's a couple of things, there's a number of things happening here. First of all, I think CLR is always grappling with the relationship between individuals and mass movements at particular conjunctions of history. So on one level, the Black Jacobins is about Toussaint Louverture, who emerges as the leader of the Haitian Revolution at the end of the 18th century and has been kind of mythologized through the 19th and early 20th century as one of the greatest Black leaders of all time. And James writes this incredible history of Toussaint Louverture and showing how his emergence was really dependent on a series of historical conjunctions, the demographics of Saint-Domingue, which is now Haiti, in terms of it's the distinction between half a million African slaves and a small amount of whites and a mulatto class, and how do you have this one former slave emerge as a leader of a revolution in that moment. But he's also concerned with the Black masses. He's concerned, CLR is concerned with not just James as a leader, but the masses of African people in Saint-Domingue as organizing and leading themselves. And so he's always trying to deal with that tension there. And I think he would even admit, I never met him, he died in 1989, but I think he would even say that he didn't accomplish what he wanted to do with the Black Jacobins because it becomes a story of the individual mm-hmm. and not a story of the masses. So there's a book by Carolyn Fick, who was a student of James, she's out in Montreal, called The Making of Haiti, that tries to tell the history of the Haitian Revolution from below by focusing more on the masses of people, but also on the role of women in the Haitian mm-hmm. Revolution. So, you know, in terms of the question of print and writing, I mean, I feel like I think a lot of writers feel like they're always in conversation with their literary ancestors, that we're always, the sentences that they write, the kind of narratives that they construct, they become a part of us, and we're always grappling with them in a kind of way. Sometimes I have to hate the writers I love because because they're too good, or because I'm trying to figure out what their limits are, or because I'm trying to find a sentence that can work with them. But if you would indulge me, I actually want to there's a couple poems I wanted to read, mm-hmm. if we have time for that.
Absolutely.
I didn't write them, but I think they're important in terms of thinking about precisely these questions and thinking about the kind of how literary texts speak to each other and how writers can capture and carry on a political moment. The first is from Claude McKay, who I mentioned earlier. He's an amazing Jamaican writer, born in 1890 and died in 1948, and came to the United States and to Harlem in, I think, the early 10s or 20s, was part of the Harlem Renaissance, was a member of the Communist Party, traveled to Moscow, wrote these amazing novels documenting the 1920s, and also wrote some of these kind of classic poems of the Renaissance. One of the poems he wrote, which was published, I think, in 1919 or 1920, is called If We Must Die. And If We Must Die represents a really kind of militant transformation within the Harlem Renaissance. It's a poem that's not about accommodation or assimilation. It's about militancy. And it's about a form of Black militancy against the waves of violence that Black people in the U.S. were subjected to after World War II. There was these pogroms across the country. Towns were being burnt. Lynch mobs were everywhere. So he writes, and I'm not a poet, so I'll do my best here. If we must die, let it not be like hogs hunted and penned in an inglorious spot, while round us bark the mad and hungry dogs, making their mock at our accursed lot. If we must die, oh, let us nobly die, so that our precious blood may not be shed in vain. Then even the monsters we defy shall be constrained to honor us, though dead. O kinsmen, we must meet the common foe. Though far outnumbered, let us show us brave. And for their thousand blows, deal one death blow. What though before us lies the open grave? Like men, we'll face the murderous, cowardly pack, pressed to the wall, dying, but fighting back. So this, for African Americans, for Black people, became this kind of anthem of resistance. But for us now, what becomes important is that poem has found its voice in a poem by a Palestinian writer, Rafida Rir, who was assassinated on December 6th by the Israelis. And Rafida Rir writes, "If I must die, you must live to tell my story, to sell my things, to buy a piece of cloth and some strings, make it white with a long tail, so that a child somewhere in Gaza, while looking heaven in the eye, awaiting his dad who left in a blaze and bid no one farewell, not even to his flesh, not even to himself, see the kite, my kite you made, flying up above, and thinks for a moment, an angel is there, bringing back love. If I must die, let it bring hope, let it be a tale." And I think that final line, "let it be a tale," it really signifies something about the power of writing, the power of storytelling, and the power of narrative, and the power of writers to both kind of continue that literary tradition, but to continue that ethos of resistance, both obviously in the African diaspora, but also in the Palestinian world.
Wow.
That was so powerful. I think, just talking about going from talking about the Haitian Revolution as a masses of people liberating themselves, and then being able to connect that tradition to other liberation movements, and right now the liberation movement in Palestine, I think is so important and so beautiful that you highlighted the language that is being used to kind of articulate this liberation.
And if I could also add, I think it's important to also recognize that while the UN is vetoing the US are vetoing a ceasefire in Gaza, they're calling for military intervention in Haiti right now. And February 29th marks the 20th anniversary of the overthrow of the first democratically elected government in Haiti in 2004, that of Jean Aristide. And I think it's, again, to bring Haiti back into the equation, I think we don't want to look at that as something that's merely historical, but understand how there's a continuity there, but also to see the continuity of resistance, as you're suggesting, between Haiti and Palestine.
Absolutely. It's very important to notice the parallels and to bring history back and to note that, yeah, these are continuous and history is not, well, the things that are happening right now, the things that we see on the news right now don't exist within a vacuum, as has been told multiple times. And in the context of like transnational or solidarity, and we must notice the ties between these acts of liberation. We're going to take a short break, but we will be back.
MRG Live presents Zahara at the Fox Cabaret on March 26, 2024. Hailing from LA's Highland Park, Zahara makes detailed melodic indie rock that flits between shoegaze, post-punk, and dream pop. Their airy melodies, pensive guitar, and heart-churning lyrics join to create a dreamy indie rock. Don't miss Zahara at the Fox Cabaret on March 26, 2024. Tickets are on sale now at admitone.com.
Hi there. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from UBC Vancouver campus, located on the unceded ancestral and traditional lands of the Hunkaminim-speaking Musqueam people. We honor the ancestral and ongoing care for this land by the host nations. Media practices are often rooted in white gaze, and we recognize that it is our responsibility to shift our approach and move towards radical empathy. While we broadcast from UBC Vancouver campus, our listenership extends to the unceded lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh nations and beyond. We encourage you to check out native-land.ca, that is native-land.ca, to learn more about whose land and territory you live and work on or may be visiting. Thank you.
We're back. This is Familiar Strangers. I'm your host, Celine, and I am joined by...
My name is Harmela. I am the president of CITR.
I'm Zainab. I'm an undergraduate student in the Department of Geography.
And Peter James Hudson, associate professor in the Department of Geography.
Yeah. We were talking about, just now, we were talking about Black literature. Or not Black literature, but... I want to say just literature as a whole and how the role it plays in acts of resistance and liberation. We're going to take a small turn. Harmela had a question that she wanted to start off with.
Yes. I'm curious as to how not only do you credit the people who came before you and your literature, your literary predecessors, so to speak, what role does intuition and a sort of knowing in your heart and knowing your own dreams that maybe you've carried since you were a child, where does that fit into your work?
That's a big question and a great question. I think the thing I'd respond by saying this. In the first instance, obviously, you know, to sit down, to write, to produce, to do certain things, one needs a certain level of confidence and trust in yourself. But I also think that confidence and trust are in some ways overrated attributes. And I say that in the sense that confidence and trust can also lead to a kind of arrogant that doesn't acknowledge self-doubt. And sometimes it's in self-doubt where the critical work begins, because it means that you're having to see things differently, you're having to look at yourself differently, and that doubt can actually be enlightening. And, you know, there's I think, probably the greatest Black artist that Vancouver's ever produced is the visual artist Stan Douglas, whose mother used to work at UBC, who he went to Lord Bing. Also graduated 10 years before me. And he has a line in an interview years ago where he talks about, he doesn't really get into questions of identity or questions of being Black in Vancouver, but he says something about the importance of doubt in the formation of his aesthetic and how he sees things, and that growing up in in Vancouver, and I'm really paraphrasing him here, is that there was always a kind of doubt about the certainty of the I, of the self, and that it was in that kind of destabilization that he was able to see the world differently. And so I think one has to kind of toggle between, you know, the confidence to sit down and write and put things on paper or produce whatever you want to produce, but also to trust that the doubt in a way that it's not crippling. Because I think I grew up with a lot of doubt here. I think if you're, the tendency, I think if you're black here or a person of color here where you're not represented, even though I'm not a huge fan of representation, but you don't exist in particular ways. And so that the things that you see, the ways that you feel are not acknowledged in particular ways. So how do you believe you even exist? You know, and but I think that position, that outsiderness, should be embraced, and you roll with it. And in some ways, it's a kind of old trope of black consciousness, right? Where, you know, Du Bois in The Souls of Black Folk writes of double consciousness and you know, the kind of two-ness of being a black and an American. And I think it's in some ways similar to what we experience here.
Oh, I am struck by the comment of how do you know you exist? Because in my first year here, this was my question, and it was like this fight. And I remember talking about it with my one friend, Gonkel, who was from Senegal and had no experience of being a minority. And then coming to UBC and being like, wow, I am invisible here. And I think also what I've noticed even in writing is that coming to understand what I'm feeling and understanding the I that I associate myself with is, somebody said this to me because they watched the Bob Marley One Love movie. And in the film, they talked about I and I. Mm. And the sense of there is not a we necessarily, it is an I and I, and the I and I, you and me, is the same, one and the same. And coming to understand that these fears and the self-doubt that I feel and these questions of my existence that I am really grappling with are not my own, and they're not just mine. And especially knowing that there's a community, a black community here, and it took until like finding a black student union to understand that. So thank you. Really, thank you.
Yeah, no, I think it's important to also say if you feel like you're crazy, you probably are crazy. And there's reasons for you to be crazy. I mean, how could you not be crazy to be like one of eight black people in a white supremacist society? Like, of course you're crazy. But that doesn't mean that you don't have to like die because of that. Mm-hmm. Like, there's reasons to live. And I think, you know, the I and I mean, I think it's such a beautiful metaphor coming out of kind of the philosophy of Rastafarianism. I mean, I think we can kind of transpose it to say, well, there's the I that's here, but there's also the I that we can inherit from literary texts. Mm-hmm. And there's the I that's here, but there's also the I that is the black world, which is our world. It's not just Vancouver and Edmonton. It's Toronto. It's New York. It's L.A. It's Kingston. It's Dakar. It's Lagos. We can embrace all of that. And I think that's, you know, as I sometimes get a bit irked by the kind of fetishization of Hogan's Alley. Mm-hmm. And I understand the need to reclaim it. But I also think that we don't have to be strictly local beings, you know. It doesn't mean we deny Vancouver, we deny this history, we deny New Westminster and Surrey or whatever it is, but that we kind of can exist in solidarity with black people everywhere, but also with non-black people who are also struggling and going through a similar kind of thing. And again, importantly, we exist with our literary and political ancestors.
We had a question related to that. Do you want to go ahead?
Yeah, I'm just taking a second to soak all of that in. That was really powerful. I think, yeah, just talking about how we imagine ourselves in a white supremacist society. We've touched a little bit about the Vancouver context and the BC context. How do you, at this moment, conceptualize, like, imaginations of blackness in Vancouver and also maybe broadly even in Canada, and how that's informed also by settler colonialism and legacies of that in this space?
Yeah, so I think that the question of blackness to me is a funny one, because I realize I don't want my work to be about blackness, mm-hmm. per se. I think I'm not interested in either performing blackness for other people. I'm not interested in debating what blackness is. I mean, if you say you're black, I'm happy. Okay, you're black. Who am I to say you're not? You know what right. I mean? And I also think that there's a way that that blackness is so easily co-opted, right? So I feel like there's more black people in Scotiabank advertising than there are in Vancouver, right? Everywhere I go, I see some there's, you know, they're opening their presents and opening a savings account and, hey, we're here. But I'm like, well, where are you on the streets, right. you know? And so, and even like with UBC or with the federal government or the province, I mean, there's a way black history rolls around and they seize on blackness, you know? And so, oh, here's Hudson, he's black. Let's put him on the arts webpage, mm-hmm. you know? It's like, and so what's important to me then as a black person writing is, and as someone who draws on black writers, is not to just draw on black writers because they're black, mm-hmm. and because that tells us anything about the world, but because that they're involved in a historical critique of white supremacy, mm-hmm. in which blackness gets configured in particular ways. And so you asked at the end of your question earlier about a comment I made about not interested in black writers because they're instantiations of blackness, mm-hmm. but that they offer us a historical critique. Well, and that's precisely it. I mean, what Claude McKay does, or what Walter Rodney does, or what Frantz Fanon does, is they offer us ways of thinking about consciousness, how black consciousness is formed in white supremacy, but I don't think they're debating blackness per se. Walter Rodney is offering us a methodology to understand how Europe was underdeveloped, how the slave trade came about, how racism came about, but he's not interested in black identity per se. And so for me, it's a methodological critique that helps us understand white supremacy, understand colonialism, understand the history of slavery, understand the history of capitalism. Because when you think about it, who understands slavery better than the slave? Mm-hmm. And so that's why we need to return to this voices. We're not interested in a slave's critique of capitalism or of slavery because he's black. We're interested because he understands slavery. Mm-hmm. If blackness is debased, well, we need to understand how that happens. But it's not just, I don't want to just pull out blackness and celebrate blackness and talk about black excellence. Mm-hmm. Yes, black excellence is great, but also I love black mediocrity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's okay to just be an average black person. Why do we all have to be excellent? Mm-hmm. And we get 28 days of the year to be excellent, and then they ignore us, mm-hmm. you know? It was telling to me, I was looking at you know, there's always debates at UBC about forming black studies and this kind of mm-hmm. thing, and you know, we have an African studies program, from what I understand. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the faculty of the African studies program, well, there's a white woman who's a full professor, and I might get my numbers wrong here. There's a couple of African faculty members who have PhDs, but who are sessionals or adjuncts. Mm. And so there's already a kind of structural imbalance, a political economy of white supremacy that the university administration is supporting, mm-hmm. by not making these two African professors full professors or associate professors or tenured professors, allowing the white woman to control things. I mean, this is very shady to me. But then they'll say, well, why don't you join a task force on racism at the university and black excellence? I'm like, well, we have black excellence, but you're not supporting it.
Right.
You know? And so, again, I'm very wary of these things, and I think we always want to look at the critique before the celebration, mm-hmm. and not get too caught up in excellence, which, again, is something we'll come around once a year, 28 days, mm-hmm. and then they'll forget about it.
I have a question. Is there a way to decentralize whiteness, white supremacy within our everyday lives? And have you found it?
I'm going to say something a little bit controversial here, and I'll probably get in some trouble for it. I think if you're a black man or a black person, you, first of all, you have a black partner and you raise black children. I mean, I think this is one of the things one needs to do, and I think you start at a kind of domestic level in the household about, you know, what is the literature in your house? What is the music in your house? What is the culture that you're bringing in the house? I think you can do it on very small interpersonal levels, which isn't to say that it's completely eradicated, but I think that's how you begin. I also think that for all of us, anywhere in the diaspora, but I think it's extremely acute in Western Canada, there's a long period of kind of decolonization that one has to go through to really begin to as Ngugi wa Thiong'o put it, to decolonize the mind, to really think about how do you take whiteness out of your own head, you know. And I think, you know, when you grow up in these environments, that's what you grow up with, and even, you know, so I think it's like it's about reading, it's about recalibrating your social relations, but it's a long and very painful process. But I think it does have to start in certain kind of more intimate formations.
You're saying a lot of things that are threatening my body right now. And I can feel it because I'm getting goosebumps and I'm going, uh-oh. But that's how I know. That's how I know. That there's truth. So thank you for that.
I think an example I can think of off the top of my head is how France Fanon, he started off identifying himself as a French, like nationality-wise as French. And he went to France and then he fought in the Second World War with the French. And then he went to Algeria. He was working as a psychiatrist or something along those lines. And along the way, he started to read more, learn more, and he was also like experiencing racism like never before, because he went from living in
Martinique,
yeah, to living in Europe now, right? And so there was this process where, I suppose, radicalization, and he, this is relating to what you were saying earlier, and he then ended up fighting against the French in the Algerian War of Independence. That is like, that's just an example I can think off the top of my head, because you mentioned Fanon, and it's just, yeah.
No, and absolutely. I mean, I think Fanon is a perfect example of this, and it's also, he's a perfect example of that process of decolonization as an imperfect process. I mean, we know he married, he had two white wives, not just one, you know. But he did go through a crazy transformation from growing up in colonial Martinique to being that kind of imperial subject of France to siding with the Algerians against the French. But and I think if you read his the kind of body of his work on Black Skin, White Mass, The Wretched of the Earth, toward the African Revolution, all these texts, you see him working through that process on the page. I mean, he's an amazing example for us. But again, I think we can all acknowledge that he wasn't perfect in in that process, and we can learn from those imperfections as well.
Yeah, I'm just thinking. I'm taking in everything you're saying. I feel like we're answering a lot of the questions that we originally had as we go. Are you thinking anything?
I mean, I think, yeah, this process of decolonizing the mind, I think, as a non-Black person, is, like, also something that has really been something that I sit with a lot. And I think, yeah, just living in Canada is such a, I was about to use a profane word, is such a difficult thing to bear. And, yeah, I think, like, zooming out and talking a little bit more about those, like, transnational solidarities and kind of seeing yourself somehow in Fanon is, like, crazy, but is possible. And, like, seeing kind of different iterations of the things that Fanon has experienced or felt in other really important, significant figures is also really cool. Kind of touching back on that I and I kind of relationship.
Yeah, I mean, a couple things I would add. First of all, in terms of that process of decolonization consciousness, especially around Black consciousness, mm-hmm. I really believe that people need to go back and read the work of Marcus Garvey. Mm-hmm. I think Marcus Garvey was a Jamaican writer who formed what was the biggest Black mass movement in history, in the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League, as part of it was founded in Jamaica, and then he brought it to Harlem in 1917, I think. And the UNIA, to use its initials, was an organization that that had like Black factories of Black nurses. It was about a kind of form of Black capitalism, but it was also about you know, he would say, why do you have a white Jesus mm-hmm. on your wall? And he would sell images of Black Jesus, mm-hmm. you know, and he created a flag for the Black race. He did all of these kind of things, which were then later taken up years later by the Black Power movement, by Rastafarians in Jamaica. He's kind of a prophet of Rastafari. I don't know if this comes up in the Bob Marley movement, but Bob Marley movie, because the Marleys are a whole other thing that we need to talk about. But you know, if you look at the kind of iconography of reggae music from the 70s, you look at the iconography of Rastafarianism, the colors you see are red, black, gold, and green. But the red, black, and green comes out of the Marcus Garvey flag, the flag of the UNIA. And that's the flag that you see in most African nations, right? And so just that kind of semiotic or symbolic transformation is important. But there's another importance for Garvey here for us. Because I said the UNIA was the biggest mass Black movement in history. Mm-hmm. It had branches all over North America, including one in Vancouver, one in Burnaby, one in Edmonton, I think one in Lethbridge and Calgary, all across the prairies and all the way to Montreal and Toronto, which had and Nova Scotia, which had the largest memberships. And partly that was because people working on the trains, Black people, reporters on the Canadian Pacific Railroad or whatever mm-hmm. it was, were setting up branches across the country here. Mm-hmm. And so this again, you know, brings us back to both that question of individual consciousness, but also the ties of Vancouver to the rest of the world. You know, that we, you know, have we excavated the history of the UNIA in Vancouver? Have we found mm-hmm. out who those members were? Have we seen that as part of our political history, just as important as Hogan's Alley? And I'm sure that people who were in the UNIA went to Vi's Chicken Shack or whatever it is down in Hogan's Alley. So I think, you know, there's all these little kind of historical kind of through lines and ties that link the geography of Vancouver to the geography of the Black world. Two other things I would say. One is people don't realize that the first degree given to the African American James Baldwin was the University of British Columbia gave him an honorary Doctor of Letters in I think 1963, mm-hmm. and he came to Vancouver and met with the British Columbia Association for the Advancement of Colored mm-hmm. People and walked on stage during commencement here and stuff like that. But it's like suddenly that history's erased. Mm-hmm. And the other thing for me, it's interesting that Joseph Trutch, who we know as the architect of land dispossession mm-hmm. in the province, we have Trutch Street named after him, and Trutch this and Trutch that, and you know, very kind of famous guy that I think Indigenous people have rightly critiqued. He lived in Jamaica for some time, and his family were slave owners in Jamaica in the 19th century. And so there's an interesting tie between Trutch, where Trutch as this embodiment of British colonialism both fuses Indigenous dispossession and African dispossession. And again, those are the kind of things that I think we need to excavate mm-hmm. and understand here in Vancouver, in this place.
I suppose my question is, like, how do we look at the micro and the macro and the dynamics between them and then engage with that? Because I think that when we talk about history, when we talk about geography, we do it in such
an isolated manner, as if like events are isolated from other events or other things that are going on in the world. How do we engage with this on a critical level?
Well, I think it's finding the connections, finding the both the connections and the ruptures. And I think, you know, one of the amazing things about going back to C.L.R. James and the Black Jacobins is this is a book that's not just about Haiti. Mm-hmm. He's also narrating what's happening within the abolitionist movement in England. He's narrating what's happening within the kind of Republican movement in France as it's happening in Haiti. And so, you know, I think we can look at places like Haiti and see how all of the forces of imperialism converge on it and tie to all these different places. So Haiti is tied to Africa, Haiti is tied to Europe, Haiti is tied to the Americas. We mm-hmm. could look at Gaza right now and do yeah. the same thing when we look at the number of forces involved, who's funding it, who's bringing in the munitions, who's dealing with refugees, who's not dealing with refugees, like all of these kind of things. And I think that's the way you want to look at geography through a series of scales.
Mm-hmm.
Again, there's one of the most important Black Canadian writers, Austin Clark, from Barbados, who was kind of popular in the 60s and 70s and then kind of went through a bit of a loaf period and then kind of returned before his death. But his memoir, Growing Up Stupid Under the Union Jack, tells of him growing up in Barbados under British colonial rule during World War II. And at one point during World War II, there's a ship a British ship that's blown up in the harbor of Bridgetown by the Germans, mm-hmm. by a U-boat or something like this. And I was reading this book recently, and I was like, oh, did this actually happen? And so I just looked up this ship, and I can't remember the name of it. It turns out the ship was built at Granville Island. that the British had the largest shipyards during World War II in Vancouver at Granville Island, mm-hmm. right? And so, again, it's Vancouver, which can sometimes seem as the edge of empire, some kind of forgotten mm-hmm. imperial outpost, becomes this important logistical node for British imperialism, mm-hmm. which is fighting fascism in Europe, but it's also repressing Black people in Barbados, and you find it in these funny objects. And mm-hmm. I think you can look at almost any object and start to ask questions of what its history is in place, and what its kind of cultural histories and uses are, and we'll be able to make those kind of connections. I also think that there's something that happens with immigrants in this country, which is they're asked to almost forget where they come from to become Canadian. Because when we first met, you said, well, my country, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, well, what's your country?
Yeah.
And I was like, why didn't you say what your country was at first?
Right? The other day I went to the doctor and she asked me where I was from. And I told her, it's Azerbaijan. And she goes, where is that? And I was like, oh, it's from near Iran. And instead of writing down the country's name, she just writes down near Iran and just continues. And I was like, wow, like, I think we are, like, it is ingrained in us to, like, forget where we're from.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think we need to keep putting that forward and showing the links and remembering the importance of all of these places in history, not mm-hmm. just on a personal level, but mm-hmm. on a kind of global level.
Yeah. What?
Harmela?
I have a quick question. Mm-hmm. Looking at all of this, how do you deal with your anger?
Quick question.
I would say as you get older, you it's easier to deal with. I think in my teens and up to my 30s, I think it was very raw. I think you translate it into writing, you translate it, I mean, depending on what your medium is, I think you can translate it into activism. And you can translate it into love with friends and family, you know. When you have kids, you I think see the world slightly differently because your life is about them and about their future as much as about your own kind of grappling with your own ego and these kind of things. And so it's like I don't think it would be productive for me to always be angry around my 11-year-old, you know? And so I think, you know, you don't want, I think Audre Lorde has an essay called The Uses of Anger, right? And she doesn't say repress it or dispel it, but channel it, you know, into productive forces. But also I think as you get older, never lose it, you know? And I think that's the, Walter Rodney was asked about C.L.R. James once, and he said, well, C.L.R. James was somebody for me who was an example that I admired of an older revolutionary who remained a revolutionary. Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually very rare in older people. You go into administration, you get become a full professor, you do this and that, you get your Maserati or whatever, and so it's easy to say, well, what's more important, protecting my mortgage or fighting for freedom, you know? And I don't say that glibly, you know? I'm a professor, I'm not on the front lines. The kind of risks to me have not been great compared to many of my colleagues. And again, going back to Palestine, where I have colleagues whose families have been wiped off this planet, whose universities have been wiped off this planet. I mean, we're sitting here very nice in the bottom of the nest on this beautiful campus on the peninsula, you know, as the rain falls, it's very beautiful and romantic, you know, but I think you need to channel it at the end of the day. And not to sound like a kind of off-brand Cornel West, but you also have to find where the love is.
I'm so sorry to start cutting this off, but we do have to start wrapping up. I will ask, is there anything you would like for, anything else you would like to talk about, anything else you would like to mention in the few minutes we have?
No, I think this has been a really great conversation. I wish I could have heard more about what you all are doing individually, but my sense is you're doing amazing things, and I think programs like this are so important. And you know, I said at the beginning of the show how important CITR was for me, and I think it's like CITR, Discorder, CJSR at the University of Alberta, Brave New Waves on CBC Radio years ago. I mean, these were institutions that saved me, and they saved me by showing that there could be another world than the world that I found myself in. And so I think, you know, you guys all need to know that you're doing that for some kids right now and how important that is. So thank you for doing it.
That was beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This was Familiar Strangers. Yeah, that was it. Please come back and listen for more in 2 weeks, I want to say. Have a great day.
Gangsta white.